Arguments 21. Irreligious goodness. While the atheist can point to the millions of people around the world who do not believe in God, much less the biblical God, and who are nonetheless good citizens, honest businessmen, and loving family members, the enthusiastic believer must wonder how this is possible. It ought not to be. If God or Allah does not sustain and develop these people's morality, then who or what does? The believer must conclude either that God loves and takes care of all good people, regardless of their faith, religiosity, or actual religion, or that the word of God has filtered through to them by other means, for example, through laws and customs, or literature, movies, and other cultural products from which direct reference to God might have been stripped, but in which the word of God nonetheless is heard. Both of these options represent a liberal position. Christian and Muslim fundamentalists have a harder time of it. They must wonder why atheists, agnostics, and followers of other religions are not precluded by God from success and happiness in this life simply for not believing in God the right way. Our theology, for its part, need not belabor an answer as to how irreligious, non-believing people can be as moral and happy as religious ones, if not more so. It can argue that many belief systems deemed not really religions by biblical or Quranic standards actually are religions and have functionally equivalent theologies. Confucianism, for example, has no God, but rather the way of heaven as its transcendent moral principle. The way of heaven is not a being or a creator, and yet its precepts are instantly recognizable as ones endorsed by our God. Taoism similarly speaks of the way of Tao. And while Buddhism has a Brahman as the supreme spirit, it is rather casual about who and how many gods there really are, their multiplicity being a remnant of ancient Hinduism. Also, they are agnostic as to which god is responsible for what. Buddhism prefers to focus attention on the importance of right conduct, speech, living, and thought at the individual level. According to the theology of theopraxy, God is alive and well in all these formulations, insofar as they lead people to actions, to ways, that preserve and promote all life. Ditto most secular moral philosophy from Plato to Kant and beyond. In the West, a great deal of religious law, based at one time on mystical encounters with God and associated with acts of moral courage in God's name, has made its way into secular law. I am thinking here of Abraham, on the advice of an angel, drawing back from murdering his son Isaac, of Moses at Sinai, bringing down the tablets of the law not once but twice, outlawing, thereby stealing, adultery, lying, etc., or of Jesus forgiving his persecutors. There are many other examples. Across the span of time delineated in the Hebrew Bible, a dozen kingdoms came and went that instituted religious law as civil law with greater or lesser success. By the 4th century CE and the Christianization of Constantine, Hebraic law, Christian salvifics, Greek philosophy, and Roman statecraft had fused into a single code, which was itself to evolve in European history into modern times. This is why such ideals as universal human dignity, the rule of law, the rights of conscience, and the pursuit of happiness, essential to both the American Declaration of Independence and the American Constitution, can so easily be traced back to Judaic law, as a book by Milton Cronwitz of 1978 proves. Indeed, so thorough has been the emulsification of religious insight into the body of civil and criminal law, that the modern atheist can claim that being good is entirely a secular matter, and something self-evidently to be desired. In the modern post-Enlightenment state or civil society, being good is 99% achieved simply by living within the law, being polite, and minding your own business. The remaining 1% is achieved through the exercise of secular virtues like patience and hospitality, for which one should just read Aristotle. Promises and threats by a supernatural entity like God are not needed, and possibly never were. The theology of theopraxy agrees. Promises and threats by God or gods are not necessary. But there are a number of weaknesses in the atheist's view, nonetheless. First, it is rather uncharitable. It's rather like calling one's teachers at high school dummies now that one is a sophomore in college. Second, atheists tend to underestimate the amount of religious sentiment that remains in their own hearts, let alone in the law, deposited there in geological layers by parents, teachers, literature, and popular culture, long before they had a choice in the matter. At the same time, they overestimate how literally, how naively, most self-described believers believe in God, which is not very literally or naively at all. But third, and saddest, is how atheists overlook the truth right under their noses, which is that God is the good they do too. If the project of enlightenment, or of the enlightenment, was to disengage morality from God, the hope of theopraxy is to weld them together again. No God without morality, no morality without God. This is because God, on any model, need not be invoked or believed in order for God, as he really is, to be present. Nevertheless, once God is mentioned in the context of doing good, and on the understanding of God that our theology tries to provide, certain gates do open. These gates may not open unto visions of heaven, or of the Almighty radiant upon his throne, but one does suddenly feel connected in reverence to the thousand-year-long quest to distinguish life-perpetuating and life-ennobling behaviors from life-destructive and life-demeaning ones, to codify and perpetuate the former and to forestall the latter in a world becoming ever more complex, and to make life meaningful, not just find it so, in acts of scientific and artistic imagination, as well as in deeds of justice, love, generosity, which are just those acts that perpetuate and ennoble all life. These acts become more than natural, more than reasonable, more than good in the everyday sense. They become holy. No individual is obliged to adopt this quest as their own, of course, nor is anyone who adopts them obliged to defer to historical notions of divinity, or even theopraxies, in order to do so. Religions are not cast in stone. They change and can be changed. Their spirit has many forms. They can be accepted in part or in full. No, the question is not, can we do without God as conveyed by this or that religion? Clearly we can. But another question, can we do without God? The atheist needs to explain why people commit themselves to supererogatory beyond the required quest, like the one I've listed, and why that commitment so often expresses itself and perpetuates itself through religious language, religious life, and religious beliefs. The answer, I think, is not that obvious. Others have written about religion from an evolutionary point of view, the basic argument being that religion, as an institution, like art or education, evolved for certain reasons. To keep populations socially structured, for example, to make people patient in the hope of eventual justice, to persuade kings to accept limits on their power, and so on. This evolutionary perspective is a good one, as far as it goes. It argues backwards from results. At the operational day-to-day level, however, another perspective on the question, why God, why religion, is called for. Here, clearly, the demands we place on each other are one source of goodness, hence religion's long insistence on promise-keeping and do unto others. But a certain emotion, of which we are all capable, I suggest, is the other source of goodness, the emotion of gratitude. This is worth discussing in more detail. Gratitude may be where religion, as the binding of oneself to God, begins, even leaving open the question of what exactly God means to you. Arguments 22. Gratitude. While the will to live on is built into every animal, just as the capacity to feel fear and relief is built in too, only human beings, it seems, have the capacity to feel gratitude for the fact of being alive. What brings on this feeling? It arises all but automatically after one has narrowly escaped death. It arises almost as automatically when good fortune strikes or when feeling extraordinarily healthy and confident. And it happens, if less elatedly, when one reflects on just a few of the myriad coincidences upon which one's own life depends. One's parents meeting just when they did, there being just the right amount of oxygen in the atmosphere for life, and so on. Now, gratitude is an interesting emotion, in that it requires two objects, that for which one is grateful, and that to which, or to whom, one is grateful. Without a for and a to, gratitude is an undirected and incoherent emotion, a welled-up feeling in search of an origin and a point of application. Here, monotheism steps in with remarkable efficiency, offering the most general object to be grateful for, namely, everything, as well as the most general object to be grateful to, namely, God. We are to be grateful to God for everything. The cognitive simplicity of this instruction, I submit, accounts in good part for the breadth of monotheism's appeal. The theology of theopraxy, however, asks for more, or rather it asks for more detail. If some person or institution gives you help when you need it, you ought to thank them, not go over their heads, as it were, and thank God instead. Consider when grace is said before the beginning of a meal in a devout Christian household, or similarly when a blessing is offered over the bread and wine in a devout Jewish household, or Bismillah is said in a Muslim one. The actual travail of the cook, as well as the labor of the household's breadwinner, are set aside. Instead, God is thanked directly. And thus is the humblest meal made miraculous. Thus does it take on the structure of a gift from God. But this practice, though well and good, does not remove the obligation to express gratitude to the people to whom gratitude is actually due, for what they actually did. I mean the people who picked the grapes, who prepared the meal, who polished the silver, who put the roof over our heads. People by the score, known and unknown to you, by whose ordinary and decent actions this meal comes to be at this table this night. Thus is God truly thanked. Arguments 23. What difference the theology of theopraxy? America boasts the highest per capita church attendance of any country in the world. The majority of Americans, when asked, profess belief in God, the word God meaning anything from an abstract higher power to the Trinity or Allah. Among them, there are many people who are kindly disposed towards religious teachings and practice, who appreciate its aesthetics, and might well go to church, synagogue, or mosque quite regularly, but who have serious reservations nonetheless. They are apt to feel dissatisfied with literal or true belief in God as God described in the scriptures or Quran. They believe in God, but in a way that is unclear even to themselves. They are convinced that science provides the more plausible explanations of things, better medicines, and sounder advice in general than religion does. They are convinced, too, that when it comes to crime and evil, the law of man is interpreted by the courts is a safer place to put their trust than the law of God as interpreted by priests, preachers, mullahs, or rabbis. They worry that religious enthusiasm can lead to great harms, as history has shown. But they know that the radical secularism or atheism is no guarantee of morality either. On the spectrum of faith, they find themselves roughly in the middle, slightly on the believing side of agnostic. By affiliation, they might be Reconstructionist or Reformed Jews, Unitarian Universalists, or religious humanists. They might also be regular Protestants, Catholics, Jews, or Muslims, keeping their doubts to themselves and being observant for the sake of the children or their parents. Or they might have no religious affiliation at all. According to surveys, people like this form roughly 14% of the world's population, and perhaps a much greater fraction if having theological reservations disqualifies one from being called an adherent to a named religion. Bishop John Shelby Spong calls these people believers in exile and counts himself among them. Here is the radical question that comes from the perspective of the theology of theopraxy. Might believers in exile be, or become, more ethical than either true believers or true atheists? And if this were the case, why might that be? Because of their generally higher education levels or concomitantly higher incomes? Or might firm belief in an indeterminate, informed but good God, together with a selective, less than convinced practice of religious ritual, be exactly the combination that is most productive of ethical behavior? Perhaps the common sense moderation that prevents most people from becoming crusading fundamentalists on the one hand or scornful atheists on the other is the same moderation that maximizes the production of good, and therefore, we say, of God. I am writing, in fact, in the main, for those good people who find themselves unable to explain why they are neither true believers nor true skeptics, who are sure God exists, but equally sure that God does not exist like the Bible or Quran says he does, or like a long-gone designer. What difference could it make to them to subscribe to the theology of theopraxy, which is, after all, a matter of the intellect? If I might address such people as you, dear reader, the difference of the theology of theopraxy could make is this. Relief to learn that your decency, generosity, courage, reasonableness, and ordinary care for others enacted is God, the real thing, the one and only God who has been God all along. No longer need you feel incapable of real faith, or for that matter of real skepticism. No longer need you feel tentative about who or what God is. God is in your hands today, just as he has always been in your hands and everyone else's. The God to whom the theology of theopraxy tries to open our minds is not some pale shadow of the God of true believers, however much they may say so. Nor is your God so overdrawn and contradictory a character that atheists can mock belief in him. You know that God is not a static entity. You know that God becomes more excellent as we do, and, God willing, continue to become. Rather than weak belief in an infinitely powerful and capricious God, you realize that, for the price of accepting a touch of personification, we can have strong belief in a loving and reasonable God, one who, because, quote, he depends on the best in us, brings out the best in us, one who, because his dignity depends on us, dignifies us, one who, because his maturation is our responsibility, makes us more responsible. This is a God we can love. You might hesitate to embrace completely the idea that God is the good we do. You may find it hard to accept that we enact God rather than just listen to him, because your disbelief in the literal truth of biblical portrayals of God has induced in you a skepticism about all truth claims about God. This is understandable. Perhaps you have been persuaded to disqualify yourself from any claim that, quote, God is in your life, because you are unable, and remain unable, to commit fully to Christ or halakha or sharia, that is Jewish law and Islamic law. There is also a chance that a college education has taught you to identify religion so completely with untruth, with oversimplification, superstition, exploitation, and backwardness, that you are simply prevented from seeing the truth you are living now. And that truth is this. Certain realities are created by humans and not found under the microscope, at the end of a telescope, or in a divinely written book given once and for all. Music, for example, mathematics, art, tennis, democracy, even the Sabbath. Where are these things? What are these things? Fabrications all, fabrications every one of them. They exist nowhere as self-sufficient entities, and yet everywhere they are being enacted or experienced. The same is true of God. God exists only when and where God is being enacted or experienced. God is an activity. Like artistic truths and political truths, religious truths are true because they refer to the realities created by human actions, bound by fealty to the goodness of God. The theology of theopraxy adds this, that the reality of good actions is the very substance of God, who is said, conventionally, only to inspire them. If you understand this, then you see that believers are right and atheists are wrong. God exists and is great. But you also see that God exists in a rather different sense of existence and is great in a rather different sense of greatness than most expect. God exists only as good doing when we do it and because we do it. God is great because performing God is supremely worthwhile at all times. God is great because as easily as God can be stopped here and there, God cannot be stopped forever or everywhere, at least not until the last human being has taken his or her last breath and all higher forms of life are extinguished. God is great because the 5,000 years of worshiping God in personified form have made God an idea and a force to be reckoned with in human affairs. It follows that not a word of the Upanishads, the Quran, the Torah, or Mishnah, or the Gospels, and not a word of the theologians, philosophers on the subject of God, happiness, justice, beauty, truth, or virtue since, has gone to waste, flawed though history might have shown some of them to be. Nor have any of the works of religiously inspired artists been unnecessary. The primordial yearning to understand, master, or conform to the reason for life's goodness continues. Arguments 24. Theopraxy. In all three Abrahamic religions, a tension exists between the relative merits of faith and works. Here is the question simply put. Which is to be more valued, strong and complete faith in God, i.e. faith, or good deeds and accomplishments, works? Although most believers would agree that having both is best, i.e. strong faith and good works, the fact that we can so easily separate the two raises the problem of priorities in cases where both are not equally forthcoming. Fundamentalists tend to take the position that good works cannot proceed from insufficient or faulty faith. Even when it seems that good things are being done, as when an atheist helps a beggar, the lack of faith in the doer will eventually come through like bad paint from under good to ruin the deed's ultimate effect or to make it unsustainable. Better is it then to do the wrong thing for the right reason than the right thing for the wrong reason. This position is held partly tautologically because actions taken without proper faith are not good by definition, and partly out of faith of a more epistemological kind. For when the long-run outcomes of an action can always be said to be not yet evident, it is impossible to prove that a deed that seems good really is good. Everything good now might turn out bad hence, and vice versa. Rather then, it is better to have a pure heart, pray, and hope. Only from the pure heart will good deeds issue. How do we know? Because a pleased God will see to it. The theology of theopraxy holds the opposite view almost exactly. Doing long-run good by any means that excludes short-run harm, on whatever theory, holding whatever beliefs and motivations, is good enough for God, one might say, which is good enough for God to come into being. Sensitivity to outcomes is our moral obligation. Foresight is a gift, not to be spurned. One cannot ask God to turn faith into works for us. The conversion is ours to handle. How one comes down on the faith versus works question says a great deal about the kind of God you believe in. Together with Judaism and Confucianism, and within Christianity closer to Catholicism than Protestantism, broadly speaking, the theology of theopraxy leans strongly towards valuing works over faith. But it is only one, but it is the only one that goes so far as to identify God with good work, or more precisely yet, with the activity of doing good works. Correct faith, even correct understanding of the theology of theopraxy, is neither necessary nor sufficient, just helpful. Nor is faith acquired by God's grace, unless by grace one means coming to a point in one's meditations when the idea of God as our good doing suddenly strikes one as obvious, as having been true all along, and feeling with that realization liberated and commissioned at the same time. The theology of theopraxy is the only theology that recommends doing good on the grounds that the practice of good and God are the same thing. God is constituted by praxis, by carrying out moral, ethical, life-promoting, and life-saving actions, not in principle, not in the abstract, not in memory, not in visions, not in prayer, and not in plan, but in moment-to-moment activity. When God's being is God's doing, and God's doing is our good doing, then God's very existence, God's being, is nothing more and nothing less than our good doing. This is the argument of the theology of theopraxy. Book 4, Reflections. Reflections 1, Godliness. The theology of theopraxy accepts the godliness of Jesus. It accepts also the godliness of Gautama, of Socrates, of Moses, Muhammad, Mohandas Gandhi, Albert Schweitzer, Raoul Wallenberg, Nelson Mandela, and Mother Teresa. But more importantly, it accepts and applauds the godliness of the many hundreds of thousands of good people whose names we do not know. People on battlefields who ran out under fire to recover the wounded. People in concentration camps who shared their rations or volunteered to do others' work. People who risked their lives or careers or reputations for justice later. People who provided shelter for persecuted strangers or who gently pushed down the gun barrel next to them. People in hospitals and churches and schools and universities everywhere, healing, teaching, searching. The repairman at midnight fixing a downed wire. The woman who feeds strays. The brother who lets his brother go first. People down the street and up the street, and perhaps in your home right now, who again and again find themselves to be sources, in ways that perhaps surprise even them, of creative moral action. The vast majority of these good people's lives were not recorded and never will be. Accounts of what they did are lost to time. But the effects of their deeds live on. Their sacrifices, their creativity, their integrity, their acts of fortitude, kindness, sagacity, and unbidden generosity have slipped silently into the stream of life's goodness for us all. God came into being through each one of them. Reflections 2, The Changing Image of God. The God that Nietzsche pronounced dead never lived. Never lived, that is, as the three great Western religions pictured God to have lived. Namely, everlastingly, transcendentally, all-wise, all-powerful, and ever-attentive to his creation. Rather, says our theology, God has always lived in and as the good people do. This God is far from dead. This God has lived as long as good things have happened at our hands. What of the disappointment, then, people might feel that God exists only in human action? How could the image of good doing, so simple, so modest, so variable and fleeting, with so many gestures and faces attached, ever replace the singular image of God of the Bible and Quran, God resplendent, creator and provider, magnificent and merciful? Can the phrase doing God's will even make sense without belief in the existence of such a kingly God? Yes, because the God that is the good we do is the God that emerged 100,000 years ago or more from the human capacity to reflect, speak, plan, and empathize, to feel remorse and to feel gratitude. Gratitude not only to the one who just helped you, but to the unseen cause of one's whole life. Yes, because this is the God that, roughly 20,000 years ago, in the guise of many gods, gave complex order to the universe and humankind a role in it. Yes, because this is the God who spoke to Abraham and stayed his hand over Isaac, and so began raising humankind out of barbarism. Yes, because this is the God who, 1,000 years later, evolved into the single, personified, but incomprehensible source of all life, goodness, truth, and power, worthy of ultimate regard, regard higher than that deserved by any god, sage, or chief, and higher than nature herself. And yes, because this is the God who, today, stripped of superstition and false strength, stands revealed as all or any one of a million acts of goodness being carried out each minute by people who are free to do otherwise. This is the God whose instruction to us, by example, and from behind the many masks we have made for him to speak through, has always been, do right and do good. Preserve, honor, and promote all forms and instances of life that do not by their very nature threaten yours. For these are near dwellers, neighbors. They have the same right to life as you do, and if human, the same duty to life, all life, as you do. Love them, therefore, as yourself. Treat them as you would like to be treated. Not everyone can form a mental image of this God, the theology of theopraxy's God, if you will. And this is both a good and a bad thing. Good in that idolatry is made that much more difficult. Good in that the formation of cults, disconnected from ordinary life, is made that much harder. But bad if the trace level of idolatry that seems necessary in order for people to address and feel addressed by God is totally eliminated. Bad if the stories long told of God stop making sense. The goal is to reduce that trace to a minimum without eliminating it. The goal is to feel comfortable contemplating God in, quote, his most resplendent older forms, from divine creator to king of kings to heavenly father, and know that these are but traces, patterns in ink and nerve endings that tell of God's arising, passing, and exemplifying what he wants. This while knowing, too, that in reality, every moment offers up the very fibers of God's being for us to make and unmake him, to weave or unweave her, depending on what we say and what we do. Reflections 3. Negating Nihilism. A quote from Friedrich Nietzsche. Nihilism stands at the door. Whence comes this uncanniest of all guests? What does nihilism mean? That the highest values devaluate themselves. The aim is lacking. Why finds no answer. Radical nihilism is the conviction of the absolute untenability of existence when it comes to the highest values one recognizes. Plus, the realization that we lack the least right to posit a beyond or an in itself of things that might be divine or morally incarnate. Nietzsche here warns of the obsolescence of the biblical God in the strongest possible terms. With God gone or dead, can we make up another? Can we posit God as a projection of our will and desire that God should exist? No, says Nietzsche. We lack the least right to posit a beyond, or God, because only from God, on the conventional understanding of God, could the right be received to posit God. Put this way, the paradox is evident. If God is dead, we cannot posit God, and if God is not dead, we need not posit God. Since God is dead, we cannot posit him, and so nihilism stands at the door. But logic, which is cast in language, is not life, which is cast in DNA, as it were, and in sun and rain. Reciprocal creation is common in evolutionary processes. Here, large-scale cause and effect mingle and loop. A given species affects the environment in which it thrives and to which it then must adapt. Species drive each other to invention. Purely psychological preferences for certain body features in potential mates causes those features to proliferate in the population. Similarly, in the processes of cultural evolution, people develop ideas like justice and build them into institutions, which in turn affect what new ideas and institutions will arise, which in turn constrain and inspire newer ideas yet, like rights. In round after round of increasing discrimination and elaboration, new entities emerge, including, long ago, gods, and more recently, God. Contra Nietzsche, then, positing God is exactly what we have the right to do and have done. And God thus posited cannot be thought of as chimerical. God thus posited is as real as the good we do, with or without the thought of his existence in mind. Among the rights given humankind by God historical, i.e. by God now dead, is the right, indeed, the obligation bequeathed to us in his will, as it were, to posit him in ever better ways. Let it be admitted, in all areas people are self-legitimating. By one means or another, we give ourselves rights and privileges over other species, not to mention other people and peoples. But only on the condition of life's increase as a whole can the project of self-legitimation proceed for very long. Our life depends on all life, and increasingly, all life depends on ours. The wheel of evolution spirals upward only because all life wants one thing, namely, more of itself, more and better life. What succeeds at effecting this trend, we tend to call legitimate, or soon make so. Ironically, we cannot ask why life wants more and better life and expect an answer. Life is that which wants more of itself and somehow knows how to get it. And what is life made of? From the physicist's point of view, life is nothing more than a set of energy patterns that propagate, promulgate, and otherwise replicate themselves, growing in complexity and degree of organization as they interact with each other over time. Enter biology. From the burgeoning variety and jostle of life forms on Earth, there emerges eventually an animal that begins to have experiences that it understands as experiences, an animal that registers its own aliveness and finitude, an animal that reflects on what more life really means, and then on how to achieve it legitimately, which is to say by using rules that are approved by or would be approved by all creatures who want more life for themselves. Why is there life at all? We need not believe that God intended life in order to justify life. Although God is good for life, life is not justified by God. Life started neither for God's pleasure nor at God's pleasure. On the contrary, God is justified by life. It is life, specifically our life, human life, yours and mine, that God relies upon for his very existence. Before we choose God to be our why go on, we are God's. In order for life to continue, then, it cannot be a matter of indifference to actual living creatures whether life should continue. Life has to be preferred to death, and pleasure has to be preferred to pain, that harbinger, that warning bell of life's end. Short-term strategies for survival and replication must be tempered and supplemented by long-term strategies for the same. The will to live is the basis for all willing as well as all living. True religion among humans is one of the activities that life has evolved to preserve, honor, and promote itself in the long term. Nietzsche gives up on radical nihilism because, as devoid of all values as it wants to be, nihilism is itself fully and haplessly the value-laden perspective of a living and longing human being. An understanding of life, or of the cosmos for that matter, from outside of life is not possible. Disillusion is still illusion, as Zen teaches. Nihilism is a picture of life taken from inside of life, as it were. It is a decision about living made by the living. Far from being objective about the absurdity or meaninglessness of life, the nihilist analysis is in fact soaked through with self-pity about both, beginning probably with disappointments in the nihilist's own life, and then drawn to the easy heroism of, quote, living without the Father. For us, as for Nietzsche and Camus, nihilism is conquered when one says yes to life for no good reason, other than that's what life is, what life wants, and what one cannot deny, at least one's body's complicity in the project. This affirmation, in the face of life's lack of grounding in any God, above, below, or beyond life itself, is the act of meaning recovery that Nietzsche hoped to teach us with Zarathustra, and indeed to exemplify himself. Is Nietzsche's teaching atheistic? Not in the view of our theology, which argues thus. Affirming life in the face of its lack of grounding in any God above and beyond life itself gains its genuinely heroic aspect not from denying God's existence, any philosophy major can do that, but from the commitment for no good reason to bringing about everything good that believers say God wants. Life's proliferation, higher consciousness, more love, an end to involuntary suffering, the realization of which, day by day, moment by moment, is the very substance of God in the first and last place anyway. One cannot get further from atheism than that. Reflections 4. Not for everyone. The theology of theopraxy is not for everyone. Like Zen Buddhism, the theology of theopraxy is a mature person's religion, best adopted by people who have lived a little, who understand the importance of abiding by the law, who have learned firsthand the wisdom of such ancient moral precepts of the Golden Rule, who have experienced love and separation, seen birth and death, who know what it's like to do good, and who have at least asked some of the big why questions. Helpful, too, is a genuine respect for what God means to believers in one or more religious traditions. One would then know that there is enough overlap between religious traditions to make it likely that a good and wise person in one tradition would be recognized as good and wise in another. In short, theopraxy assumes, indeed it requires, that those who would consider consciously engaging in it have at least the beginnings of wisdom. It follows that the theology of theopraxy, which is to say theopraxy's intellectual, reflective side, is not well suited to those in whom the basic principles of morality must still be established. Children and young adolescents, for example, but also the insane, the deeply ignorant, the long misled. Here, rather, some moral authority is required in order to inculcate habits of common human decency, at least at first, as a starting point. Until this foundation is laid, the theology of theopraxy offers little of value and could even be unhealthy. For example, if one touted to a morally untutored audience that God is in our hands, without conveying how or why or in what sense this is true, the apparent fictionalizing of God could be taken as an admission that God doesn't really exist and therefore cannot have authority. Worse, Some could come to see themselves as more powerful than God, and tragically mean God of the Bible. It takes maturity and intelligence of the sort I described in the first paragraph to understand that some fictions are more precious than others, and that God is the most precious of them all, and not a fiction at all, if and as we act on it. It takes some wisdom to see that God's being in our hands increases rather than decreases our obligation to find out who or what God is. When the theologian and rabbi Richard Rubinstein met Swami Muktananda of Ganeshpuri for the first time, the guru said to him, "You mustn't believe in your own religion. I don't believe in mine. Religions are like the fences that hold saplings erect. Without the fence, the sapling would fall over. When it takes firm root and becomes a tree, the fence is no longer needed. However, most people never lose their need for a fence." Let us ask ourselves and answer truthfully, am I getting along without religion's fence entirely? Can my children? Was the Swami? Reflections 5. Six Kinds of Prayer. All theistic religions sanction prayer of some sort. Here is one way to categorize them. Prayers differ from each other in timing and intention. With regard to timing, there are deliberate and extended prayers, which usually involve a degree of planning, usually follow religious canon, and are often spoken, chanted, or sung out loud, sometimes in unison, for minutes or even hours on end. There are also spontaneous and momentary prayers, which are offered without planning, which need follow no particular formula, are usually silent, and might last for a few seconds or less. With regard to intention, some prayers or parts of prayers are laudatory, praising God for his power, mercy, justness, for creating the universe, and so forth. Others give thanks to God for making life possible or for some particular benefit or gift received. And thirdly, some prayers are petitionary, asking God for protection, strength, forgiveness, wealth, health, wisdom, or to take some special action on our behalf or for our family or countrymen. Combining the two timing and three intention alternatives together, we get six kinds of prayer. 1. Deliberate and extended laudatory prayer. 2. Deliberate and extended thanksgiving prayer. 3. Deliberate and extended petitionary prayer. 4. Spontaneous and momentary laudatory prayer. 5. Spontaneous and momentary thanksgiving prayer. And 6. Spontaneous and momentary petitionary prayer. Given the familiarity of the first three kinds, I should like to focus on the last three, starting with the very last, because it reveals something about sensus divinitatis, our sense of the divine. Spontaneous and momentary petitionary prayer, I would suggest, is all but instinctual and pan-human. Imagine standing on a curb and crying out to oneself, "Oh, please, don't let that car hit that child." Or waiting in a doctor's office for test results and repeating silently, "Oh, please, let me not have cancer." The petition might go out to God, to the gods, to the powers that be. It might go out to fate or the universe as a whole. No matter, it is still prayer. Children and gamblers are well acquainted with spontaneous and momentary petitionary prayer, as are soldiers in battle, athletes and fans at sports events, and patients and their loved ones in hospitals, whether they are atheists, agnostics, or believers. In all these cases, the desire to change the apparent course of events is so fervent, and what would make the difference between disaster and safety, failure and success, is so small, that we feel compelled to invoke every occult force we are capable of imagining in order to deflect fate, and this whether or not at a calmer moment we really believed in such forces or fate or in God at all. Does the existence of spontaneous and momentary petitionary prayer by atheists pose a problem of consistency for them? It's commonly thought to. Recall the taunt, "There are no atheists in foxholes." But we can say that it does not. Helplessness in the face of an impending disaster is so strong an emotion that it can throw the staunchest of realists into superstition. To judge atheists intellectually inconsistent because of their atavistic favor in extremis is not entirely fair. All it proves is that atheists are human. More telling, perhaps, is that spontaneous and momentary thanksgiving prayer, our fifth type, can happen after critical events have passed. When disaster is averted, even atheists can feel overcome by feelings of gratitude. A gratitude to, well, who or what? The emotion of gratitude, the desire to give thanks, is real, spontaneous, pre-intellectual, and undirected, as we discussed earlier in Arguments 22. Within seconds, it seeks a to whom or a to what in order to make sense of itself. Unbidden, gratitude turns to spontaneous, momentary thanksgiving prayer, whether to Lady Luck, fate, God, or the universe. Whereas spontaneous and momentary petitionary prayer and spontaneous and momentary thanksgiving prayer are common, spontaneous and momentary laudatory prayer, our fourth type, is exclusively associated with traditional belief. I think this is because few people are moved instinctively, atavistically, to express praise as distinct from thanks in general. One usually knows to whom praise is due. For the wonderful food, the good cook. For an interesting book, an interesting author. For the world as a whole, God the Creator. The atheist has no one to praise for the world as a whole, nor probably does he or she want to. Why? For one, because the world as a whole has too much in it that is bad and accidental. And for another, praise of God, like praise of powerful people, is often motivated by self-interest. Interestingly, the deist can have praise for the Creator, having just expressed awe at the intricate immensity of nature, but no one to deliver that praise to. Fellow human beings can witness it, to be sure, but they cannot receive it. For its part, and pragmatic to a fault, the theology of theopraxy endorses all forms of prayer that support the doing of good by those who pray, and opposes all forms of prayer that support fatalism, passivity, feelings of entitlement, or lack of curiosity. Certainly the existence of spontaneous and momentary prayer among the faithful and non-faithful, among theists, deists, pantheists, panentheists, atheists, and theopractitioners alike, speaks of a responsibility-seeking, God-creating impulse in human nature, one that predates formal religion and that will probably post-date it too. Sensus Divinitatis. Here is a man, getting on in years, who does not believe in God the way he thinks he should. Depending on who asks, he says that he's an atheist or an agnostic. Every so often he visits a cemetery and lays flowers on the grave of an old friend. Then he rests against a tree. If, as he rests, he thinks that something has been done, something more, even a little more than the arousal of his own memories and feelings, then he is a believer, despite his theological misgivings. If in the hours and days that follow he is a kinder person, more patient or more brave in some life-affirming way, then he is a subscriber to the theology of theopraxy, although he might never have heard of it. Perhaps a stranger saw the man lay flowers and rest against the tree. If seeing the stranger see him, although being seen was not his purpose, and although the stranger might mistakenly think him devout, if seeing the stranger see him does not displease him, then he is a subscriber to the theology of theopraxy too. For something was done in that cemetery, something good, something holy, registered in the book of the world as having happened in one and perhaps two locations. God is as good happens. Where good is, God happens. Theopraxy would have us do many traditional things, but it requires no traditional faith. Reflections 6. George Santayana. George Santayana, in his 1905 book Reason in Religion, came close to rendering the essential insights of our theology. Here is Santayana. The doctrine that the physical universe is the creation of a supremely good personal identity is a pictorial rendering of the insight that everything in the world is potentially usable for the enrichment of human life. The Christian story of the incarnation, sacrificial death and resurrection of Jesus Christ is but a way of making the point that self-sacrifice for others is of supreme moral value. It is worthwhile embodying these moral insights into theological doctrine because this vivid presentation, together with the systematic cultivation of feelings and attitudes that accompany it, provides a more effective way of getting across the insights than would a bald statement. A Harvard philosopher, raised as a boy in Catholic schools, Santayana thought that religious belief was a developmental stage, rather like adolescence, through which humanity was passing. Religion, he wrote, is the natural reaction of the imagination when confronted by the difficulties in a truculent world. We should give credit, he thought, to the great religions for bringing humankind out of an earlier darkness. But it was time now for religion to step aside for the greater light shed by science, reason, literature, beauty, justice, and all the other expressions of the best in humanity. Santayana looked forward to a world without God except in the most abstract deist form, and therefore a world without God worship, prayer, ritual, or religion. The theology of theopraxy, by contrast, recommends neither belief in a deist God nor the elimination of religion. It holds that God is composed by the very narratives, images, and maxims translated by the religious language that Santayana thinks we can do without, together with all the poetry and science that strives to discriminate the good, true, and beautiful from the bad, false, and ugly. I use the phrase composed by advisedly, because these processes are not God until they are brought into the concrete and sensuous world, until, that is, like music, God is performed through free human action. God, thought of this way, is no less demanding of a response from us than the biblical God. The God that the theology of theopraxy beholds is no abstraction. In all but the darkest pits of hell, God is performed and witnessed directly in 1,000 ways every day. The image of God presented in religious canon has its reasons. God's omniscience in dealing out mercy and justice, for example, stands as a model for us and a lesson to take the largest and most objective view possible in making decisions involving others. But whereas the manifest inconstancy of God's expression of his divine attributes is a mystery to conventional believers, it is no mystery at all to subscribers to the theology of theopraxy. God's inconstancy is our inconstancy reflected back upon us. Similarly, God's freely chosen self-limitations are our necessary limitations reflected back upon us. Infallibility is not an essential attribute of God. The only consistent and necessary attribute of God is goodness in action. Are we consistently good in everything we do? No. Nor does goodness occur everywhere and always, but rather here and there. It follows that God, quote himself, it follows that God is in existence not everywhere, always, but here and there. So, atheists are partly right. When and where evil is being done, then and there God does not exist. Goodness defines God linguistically and conceptually. Actual good doing is what brings God into actual being. Whosoever does God's will, then, enacts God's very existence. God is like a flame lit by us and shining upon us in return. It's no wonder that God has had a human face for so long.